Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
The idea that Black Americans should make a deliberate effort to be better than those prejudiced against them is reprehensible to many modern advocates for social change and equality. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The politics of respectability suggests that, fair or not, members of marginalized groups can benefit from projecting an image that runs counter to racist views. The idea is that those affected by racism need to behave, achieve, and even dress in ways that are above reproach at all times, and especially in mixed company. Critics argue such efforts reinforce the notion that Black culture is somehow inferior to white culture. But my guest believes there are still good pragmatic reasons for encouraging African Americans to carefully cultivate a positive image, not simply for themselves as individuals, but for their peers as well. Randall Kennedy is Michael R. Klein Professor at Harvard Law School. His essay, Lifting as We Climb, A Progressive Defense of Respectability Politics, appears in the October issue of Harper's Magazine. Randall, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
You write that any marginalized group should be attentive to how it is perceived. Can you talk about how that pertains to you, the situation of African Americans?
Sure. Well, first of all people, and I mean all people, need to be attentive to how they present themselves. And in fact, we all are attentive. If you're looking for a job, for instance, you go to your job interview dressed a little bit differently, probably more formally than you would if you were going to the gym. If you're speaking with a person who's a prospective boss, you probably speak with that person in a somewhat different way than you talk with a member of your family. So we're all attentive to the way in which we need to present ourselves. That's just a pragmatic way of getting along in the world and making your way in the world. This is especially true if you are a member of a marginalized, oppressed group like Black Americans are. If you're marginalized, if you're oppressed, you face special burdens. You face the special burden of having all sorts of racist stereotypes. They are unfair, but they are still very much in existence. You have to face those. And one way of dealing with those is to stay clear of them and to undermine them by conducting yourself in a way that belies them. And then finally, if you're a reformer, if you're an anti-racist reformer trying to undo racism, then you have yet another burden, because reform is very difficult to accomplish. And in advancing a reformist agenda, I think you have to have the mindset of people like Thurgood Marshall, the great Mr. Civil Rights, the great civil rights attorney and first Black justice on the Supreme Court. You have to have the mindset of the great students of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. You have to have the mindset of Martin Luther King Jr. And these are people who thought long and hard about how they presented themselves in order to advance the cause of racial justice in the United States.
Thurgood Marshall is an American hero all around, a particular hero to African Americans. Before he became a Supreme Court justice, he was quite selective about the civil rights cases he chose to represent.
He certainly was, especially the criminal cases. He represented all sorts of people, but he was very attentive to the reputation of the organization for whom he fought. Particularly the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. He was well aware of all sorts of racist stereotypes still in existence in the United States. The idea of Black people, especially Black men, being criminal. And so he would often, before he would represent someone, he would do his own investigation. And he was loath to represent what he viewed as just common criminals. If somebody was just a common criminal, his position was, well, I hope you get representation, but I'm not going to risk sullying the reputation of the NAACP, having the NAACP represent you. That was a dilemma that he faced. It was a position that he took. There were, you know, wonderful people who disagreed with that position. But in my article in Harper's, I simply wanted to put it out there that this is a position that he took because he was very attentive to the problem of of racism. It wasn't that he was truckling. It wasn't Uncle Tomish on his part. He simply recognized that he had a tough way to go, being a person who was challenging racism, and to do that, he thought he and his organization had to be beyond reproach.
This plays into conversations we're having in this country right now about police shootings of unarmed suspects or unarmed individuals who are African American. And you talk about the fact that there are some cases that seem to be so cut and dry that they are ideal examples, and then there are others that are more problematic.
Yes, I think it's this problem of police violence against Black people. First of all, it's a long-standing problem. Very long-standing.
We're just talking about it more now.
We are talking about it more, and we should be talking about it. And I want to salute those who are talking about it, including the people in Black Lives Matter. I want to salute them because this is a major problem in our society, and we need to confront it. Now, in confronting it, we do face real dilemmas. I mean, one problem is the fact of criminality. I mean, ordinary people do need the police. We need the police to protect us against criminality. You know, that's one part of it. At the same time, we need the police to conduct themselves as they ought to conduct themselves. And so in criticizing the police, I think it's incumbent upon reformers to be very careful about what they say, about how they act, about the slogans that they use, about how they come across. Because, you know, there are a lot of people who, you know, they're not really all that mindful of what's going on. They might turn on the news. They might watch a story for just 5 minutes. They don't know a whole lot. And so if you're a reformer, you've always got to be attentive to how you're going to come across in that 5 minutes when people who don't know a whole lot are watching, because the audience that does not know a whole lot is still a very important audience.
You grew up in a house where your father would tell you repeatedly, tie, tie, you lose. Can you talk about what he meant by that?
Sure. My father was from Louisiana. My mother was from South Carolina. They were refugees from the Jim Crow South. They had seen racism and had suffered under anti-Black racism all their lives. They knew how pernicious it was, how deep-seated it was. And what my father and mother were telling me was, listen, kid, things are getting better. That's true. But you in your life are going to face racism. You are. So get prepared for it. What that means, it means many things. But one thing that means is in competition, you have got to be better in every way than your white peers. That's what my father meant by tie, tie, you lose. If it's close, you cannot expect to get the nod. So don't make it close. Just be better in every way. And this had real consequences, and some of them were, you know, a real burden. So when I was in high school, my father said, listen, I know that lots of kids, I went to a predominantly white school. He said, well, I know lots of kids are, you know, Friday and Saturday night, they're going to go to parties and they want to have a good time. That's all well and good. But, you know, if you go to a party and let's say there's too much drinking, and one of the neighbors calls the police and the police come to the party, when the party is broken up, when the lights come on and the police are trying to make a split decision as to which kids they let loose, which kids they take down to the station house, which kids are going to put under intense surveillance, you can bet your bottom dollar that you're going to be the kid who, if there's a problem, the police are going to really set their sights on you. So, you know, my father's position was don't go to parties where there's going to be boisterousness. Just don't go. It's not worth it. It's a risk that you should avoid. And I followed his advice.
And you ended up at Harvard Law School, so clearly it was good advice. Is there evidence, though, Randall, that African-Americans who practice respectability politics find themselves any less affected by racism than those who don't?
Well, a couple things. Number one, you can be prudential. You can try to, you know, keep your nose clean. You can try to walk the straight and narrow and still terrible things might happen to you because of racism in America. I am not saying that simply acting right is somehow going to be the magic bullet, is somehow going to immunize you against bad things happening. I am not saying that. What I am saying, however, is that you can play the odds. You can improve the odds of survival. You can improve the odds of flourishing by handling yourself in a good, wise, prudent way. You can improve the odds for your protest movement by conducting yourself in a way that does not needlessly alienate people, that does not needlessly push away people who might otherwise come onto your side.
You don't want to needlessly alienate people. At the same time, I would imagine you want to avoid tacitly granting authority to a majority culture that set the rules that make things unfair for African Americans.
Yes. And as I said before, the mission of reform, the project of reform, is very difficult. Let's take some of my favorite reformers, the Early Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Now, on the one hand, they were being arrested. They were being thrown into paddy wagons, and older black people were saying, gosh, look at these kids. They're being arrested. There were some people who were calling them disreputable. They were troublemakers. And in a certain sort of way, that's true. But I love them. I love John Lewis and the great Julian Bond, who recently passed away. They were troublemakers, all right. But they were troublemakers who thought long and hard about how they presented themselves. So in the 1960s, the early 1960s, when you see those films of those students, dignified black students sitting in, they conducted themselves in a way that even won the grudging admiration of intelligent segregationists. They were people who conducted themselves so admirably that they had people watching on television saying, look at those kids. I admire them. I want to be with them. They won people onto their side. Now, there are judgments that one has to make. Sometimes you do have to disrupt things. I'm not against disruption. We do need to disrupt business as usual when business as usual means that black people are being deprived of their rights. But you can disrupt things in a way that is attentive to onlookers, that is attentive, like I've said so many times already, to people who could be drawn to your side.
How did respectability politics emerge as a strategy for attaining civil rights?
Well, this is black people been thinking about this, since the 17th century. Mm. At every point, black people have been thinking about this. We could go back to, of course, the great Frederick Douglass. We could talk about all sorts of groups that have been, the great Mary McLeod Bethune, the great Rosa Parks. At every point, black people have had to strategize about, how can we present ourselves? How can we present our protest in a way that will get us what we need to get to survive and flourish in America?
Randall Kennedy is my guest. He's professor of law at Harvard University and author of an essay called Lifting as We Climb, A Progressive Defense of Respectability Politics. It appears in the October issue of Harper's Magazine. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with test preparation courses for graduate school admission, including the GRE, GMAT, and LSAT. smu.edu/test prep.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest, Harvard Law Professor Randall Kennedy, is the author of an essay in the October issue of Harper's Magazine called Lifting as We Climb, a progressive defense of respectability politics. If you'd like to weigh in on the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Randall, you mentioned Rosa Parks a few minutes ago. She was not the first person to engage in the act of civil disobedience that she did by sitting down in the front of the bus when she was expected to go to the back because she was black. Why was she the right person around whom to build this campaign and around whom to sort of publicize the fact of her act of civil disobedience?
Yeah, activists in Montgomery in the mid-1950s were looking for someone who they could put forth as a representative of the community in challenging racist mistreatment on the buses. And there were a couple of people who they thought of rallying around. There was a young teenager, and they initially they were going to build a lawsuit around her, but then it was discovered that she was pregnant and unmarried, and E.D. Nixon, who was probably the leading civil rights organizer in Montgomery, thought that she would not serve as a good face for the movement because there would be a lot of people, certainly in the white community and in the black community, who would look askance at her status as an unmarried, pregnant woman. So he did not have the community rally around her. Then there was another person who he thought might serve in this function, but it turned out that her father was an alcoholic. And again, he thought, well, you know, there's going to be a lot of attention placed on the person who is sort of our standard bearer, and this might not be the person. Then Rosa Parks. And it was at that point that E.D. Nixon said, this is our person. Everybody in the community knows that Rosa Parks is totally upstanding. She's strong. She's a person who is above reproach. This is going to be our standard bearer.
Of course, I know that you can understand the frustration of people who see this a different way, that it shouldn't matter if this teenage girl was pregnant or if someone else had an alcoholic father, that they were being discriminated against and therefore they shouldn't have to be the best possible citizen to just get the kinds of rights that white Americans take for granted.
Of course. And I'm not saying it was fair. Racism imposes all sorts of unfair burdens. When you're trying to undo racism, it seems to me, just being realistic, you're going to have to understand, you're going to have to just realize that you're going to have to take on certain burdens. They are unfair, but to undo an unfair system, you're going to have to strategize. You're going to have to do certain things that are actually going to be unfair, and is a burden that you should have to take on? Of course, you should not have to take on this burden. The question is, what do you do realistically to effect change?
You use this metaphor of a person hurt in a drunk driving accident, not to blame in any way for what an intoxicated driver did, but they're still going to have to work hard in physical therapy to regain their health.
That's right. The fact that, you know, you've been hurt through no fault of your own, that's true. But then the question is, you know, what are you going to do about it? And again, if we go back to Montgomery, Alabama, one of the great moments in the history of black America, in fact, in my view, one of the great moments in the history of the world, you saw people that understood the situation and engaged in a sensible type of respectability politics. Now, let me say, by the way, that, you know, do people that advance what I'm talking about make mistakes? Sure they do. So there are people, for instance, who in the 1940s and the 1950s said that black people should forswear jazz because, you know, jazz was viewed as, disreputable in some quarters. More recently, there are people who said, you know, black people should eschew rap, mm-hmm, because after all, there's some people who engage in rap who seems sort of unsavory. There were some people in the 1960s who said, well, black people, if they're demonstrating, they should demonstrate in coat and tie, should not demonstrate in overalls. You know, are there mistakes made? Of course there are mistakes made. Can you go overboard in trying to get on the good side of the people who are oppressing you. Yeah, of course you can go overboard. There are judgments that have to be made. All I'm saying is let's think hard about the judgments that we want to make.
All right, let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Gil on the line in Dallas. Hello, Gil.
Yes. Hi, Chris. Great show. Very glad to hear your speaker. I had to smile when he was describing the wiseness of very carefully thought out self-conduct. In the 1960s and 70s, there was a truly great man named William S. Willis, Jr., who was a professor at Southern Methodist University, notably a bastion of white conservatism. Willis was the second black, I think, to receive a Ph.D. in anthropology from Columbia University. He was also wealthy. His father had been the supporter of the black insurance industry in Dallas during the Depression, and in fact, Willis owned what has now become Bryan Place. His conduct was calm. His demeanor was understated. He was a brilliant ethnohistorian, and all of us kids got it, but it drove the misogynistic and somewhat racist administration of the department and the school to some extent, all parties now deceased, of course, absolutely crazy. They could not rattle this man, no matter how they backbit, underplayed his efforts, made jokes. And he was a paragon of the kind of behavior you're describing as studying one's moves to the extent that we adopted his methods. He was a walking exemplar to Machiavelli, I suppose. But he was one of the greatest professors I've ever known, and I can say one of the great pleasures in my life was watching him operate.
Well, Gil, thank you so much for that call, and I really appreciate you sharing that story of Professor Willis. He sounds like an amazing individual. Anything in there that you want to respond to, Randall?
I very much appreciate the call, and I would simply say that that example could be multiplied hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of times. The fact of the matter is black people in the United States have had to face a lot, and they still do. And the question is, how do we continue with our efforts to climb? And all I'm saying is in pursuing the racial justice agenda, all of us need to be attentive to the difficulties, including the difficulties of people just being ignorant. There are a lot of people who, they really don't know much about America. You know, what about people who've just come to the United States? They don't know a whole lot. And so you've got to teach people. You've got to win people over. You've got to be persuasive. And in doing that, you have to watch what you say. You have to watch what you do. You have to watch the way you comport yourself. That should not be in any sense viewed as demeaning. That's not demeaning. That's taking care of business.
Let me ask you this, Randall. Gil happened to mention that Professor Willis grew up with fairly significant wealth. It would seem like it's easier to do respectability politics if you or your family have already achieved middle-class status or beyond that. What is this harder to do when you're also coping with the challenges of poverty on top of whatever injustice that racism puts into your life?
Probably so, because everything is harder to do when you are facing impoverishment. So I have no doubt. I have no doubt whatsoever that it is more difficult to do. I have no doubt that it's more difficult when you are really facing just really desperate circumstances. I'm sure it's more difficult to do when you've been trying, and it seems like nobody is listening to you. And so, it's easy under those circumstances sometimes to fall into the mindset that, well, frankly, what the hell? Nobody's listening. It doesn't matter what I do. So sure, the lower down you are, the more that you have to scrap, I'm sure that to the extent that that's that impoverished people face more difficulties, I'm sure it's more difficult for impoverished people to do what I'm suggesting that people ought to do.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have John on the line in Dallas now. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Great. Professor Kennedy, it's actually a big honor to talk to you. I'm a political conservative, but I've read a lot of your work and benefited from it greatly. I wanted to ask you a question about the debate between W.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, and I've always been curious where you come down on their dispute and which side you would have been on if you'd have been around back then.
Well, of course, you've just named two of the giants in African-American history, two of the giants of American history. To tell you the truth, I embrace them both. You know, Booker T. Washington, born a slave, he's in Alabama at a time of just tremendous racist reaction. He is trying to advance the cause of black people at a time when lynching is, you know, is prevalent in the Deep South. And in the he's trying to advance the cause of black people when disfranchisement has occurred. And so, of course, he's very attentive to the politics that I'm talking about. He is trying to advance the cause of black people when racism is ascendant. And, you know, I admire Booker T. Washington in many respects. I don't admire everything he did, but in general, I admire him. And, you know, given his circumstances, he did what he thought needed to be done. And lots of what he thought needed to be done was quite sensible. Now, then let's turn to W.E.B. Du Bois. W.E.B. Du Bois is born in Massachusetts. He goes to school. He's the first Ph.D. in the United States. He gets his Ph.D. He goes to Harvard, for goodness sakes. He's living, I mean, he lived in the North and in the South, but, you know, he was in easier circumstances than Booker T. Washington. He was freer to write what he wrote. He was freer to say what he said. And so, frankly, both of them, I think, pushed different agendas. Both of them engaged in different strategies. I think both of them had a purchase on wise conduct given different circumstances. I think it's a mistake to sort of choose one over the other. I take the best from both.
To be clear, the dispute between them had to do with educating the talented 10th versus educating all African Americans. Is that what we're referring to?
Well, they had various disputes. I mean, Booker T. Washington, in his most famous speech, basically said, listen, black people under these circumstances need to attend to business. They need to attend to, you know, vocational education. They need to just make money, get farms, forget about being social equals. Even let's de-emphasize political rights. Let's focus on getting our economy in shape. Let's be independent on our own two feet, farmers. And then once we do that, once we're good mechanics, once we're good farmers, once we can sort of take care of ourselves, then let's talk about these other things. W.E.B. Du Bois thought that that strategy was not well taken. He said, listen, we've got to be attentive to our political rights, because if we don't have our political rights, we won't get our economic rights either. Again, I think both of them had a point.
You write about the Women's Convention of the National Baptist Convention. This was a group of African-American women back in the 19-teens. Members were advised to fight segregation through the courts as an unlawful act, but also to fight it with, and here's a quote, soap and water, hose, spades, shovels, and paint to remove any reasonable excuse for it.
Yes, and what they were saying basically was, number one, we know we are being subjected to racist mistreatment. We know that. And we want to fight that. We think that's terribly unfair. And we're going to fight that in every way that we can. One way to fight that is for us to keep our neighborhoods up, for us to look after our children, for us to look after our neighbors' children, for us to conduct ourselves in a way that is beyond reproach. So frankly, the white people can't say anything bad about us that will be true. That was one of their strategies. And I take my hat off to them. That was their way of fighting racism in their circumstances.
What do you say to people who believe that respectability politics was tried and didn't work?
Well, I just say to them they're just mistaken when they say it didn't work. You know, listen, we are racism is still a big problem in the United States. Obviously, I've said that over and over and over again, and it's true. At the same time, the history of black people since 1865, that is to say, the history of black people since their emancipation from slavery, is one of the glorious histories in all of world history. We are just a couple of, black people are just a couple of lifetimes away from chattel slavery. 1865 is not that long ago. And if one takes a look at what black people have been able to accomplish in that period, it is absolutely remarkable. And one of the things that has enabled black people to do what black people have been able to do, including have a black American as president of the United States, we've had to do lots of things. We've had to demonstrate. We've had to litigate. We have had to be twice as good. And we have had to practice respectability politics. All of those things we have engaged in, and all of those things have helped us to advance in American life.
Harvard Law Professor Randall Kennedy is my guest. We're talking about his essay in the October issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called Lifting as We Climb, a progressive defense of respectability politics. You can find it online. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with test preparation courses for graduate school admission, including the GRE, GMAT, and LSAT. smu.edu/test prep.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Randall Kennedy. He's professor of law at Harvard University, and he has an essay in the October issue of Harper's Magazine called Lifting as We Climb, a progressive defense of respectability politics. Randall, one thing that's very interesting, if you consider the history of people of African descent living in the United States, it is absolutely a history of persecution and injustice and suffering. It is also equally a history of resilience and persistence and ultimately triumph, which doesn't mean that either one is a complete telling of the story. But if you focus on the second set of characteristics in terms of African-American history, it just looks and feels different.
Well, if the second set being the matter of resilience.
Yeah,
well, you know, I think it's useful to remember what's the name, the title of what's unofficially known as the Negro National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing, one of the great patriotic songs, one of the great songs in American life. And this was a song that was written at the during the nadir of American race relations, at a time when there was no real good reason for black people to have any sense of optimism, yet it was an optimistic song. It's a great song. It's an inspirational song. And it's the ethos behind Lift Every Voice and Sing that I think has given buoyancy to many African American communities and enabled many African Americans to step up, step forward, and continue to step forward.
To what extent would you call President Obama an example of the effectiveness of respectability politics?
Well, I mean, Barack Obama is a great exemplar. Barack Obama is a person very attentive to racism. He knows the score. He also knows how difficult it is to make one's way in the face of racism. And therefore, he knows that it requires a tremendous amount of discipline to continue to fight the fight in an effective way. It requires a tremendous amount of discipline. And what does discipline mean? Sometimes discipline means getting out there and being disruptive and shouting and screaming and making your presence known. That's, you know, sometimes that's required. At the same time, sometimes discipline means being quiet. Sometimes discipline means modulating your voice. Sometimes discipline means taking a compromise even when you think you are getting too little. Sometimes disciplined reformism can take lots of different, it can come out in lots of different ways. And I think Barack Obama has shown the variety of ways that, you know, it can take. And he's a person who I think has certainly made it in American life. I mean, you know, a black person to become president of the United States, that in and of itself is pretty miraculous. And anybody who can pull that off is a person who, it seems to me, has a lot that they can say to anyone trying to better their condition.
Do you think the challenges that he has overcome are fundamentally different than many other black Americans because he is not the descendant of people held in slavery?
Yes. I think that in an ironic way, Barack Obama was helped by certain things. You know, his mother was white. I think that helped him. I think that helped him. There's some people who, you know, just historically who have viewed mixed race people in a different way than they have viewed more dark, you know, people who were, you know, sort of clearly people of, totally African descent. We still live in a pigmentocracy, so that if you're a person who's mixed race, a person who's lighter skinned, black people are often given more of a benefit of the doubt than darker skinned black people. I think that his mother was white helped him in the estimation of some people, particularly white people. I think the fact that he was from Hawaii helped him. You know, there were some people who said, well, was this guy really born in the United States? Yeah, there was the birther problem. On the other hand, there were some people who I think probably were willing to give him more of a benefit of the doubt because, you know, his background was somewhat unusual. Even his unusual name, Barack Obama. You know, I think that if his name was Tyrone Washington, let's say, from Detroit, Michigan, I think, frankly, there would have been some people who would have been less inclined to pull the lever from Tyrone Washington from Detroit, Michigan, than for Barack Obama from, you know, Honolulu, Hawaii.
Back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Frank in DeSoto. Hello, Frank.
How are you?
Very well, thanks.
So glad to talk to Professor Kennedy. I think that there's a larger question that he on the place, both with the president and with the protest movements, and that is that the question of respectability arises often because of the failure of especially established institutions that in the civil rights movement are today, from the NAACP, black fraternity sororities, et cetera, to address issues forcefully as organizations like SNCC originally sprung up. Or look at today. Professor Kennedy excuses the president's avoidance of even placing things on the agenda that are great concern to black folks as if it's some kind of strategy rather than the only kind of politician that would avoid issues for his base, which almost it's expected in politics that folks who vote 95% and 93% for you that you would be responsive to some of the things of high unemployment, and instead using that political clout for, even though it was deserved, for folks who are illegal aliens or for folks who are gays and lesbians.
Thanks so much for your call. I really appreciate it, Frank. What do you think, Randall?
I think that the caller has good points. I mean, you know, I don't think that Barack Obama is immune to criticism, that he shouldn't be criticized. I've certainly been critical of him in certain ways. On the other hand, think about John F. Kennedy vis-a-vis Catholics. You know, the pioneers always are going to have to be self-conscious and step lightly. John F. Kennedy, being the first Catholic president, leaned over backwards, frankly, to prevent people from being able to say, well, look, you know that John F. Kennedy is certainly going to, you know, is going to show favoritism towards the Catholics. He leaned the other way, and there were some Catholics who were very bitterly opposed to him, or very bitterly critical of him for that reason. Frankly, I think the same has happened with Barack Obama to a certain extent. Sure, he's going to be very attentive, keenly attentive to the problem of people saying, ah, see, we got, you know, black president, he's going to show, you know, racial nepotism. So sometimes I think that he probably has leaned too far the other way. That's true, but that, you know, that's the problem of being a pioneer. And, you know, it's a judgment call, but nonetheless, I'm very, I admire Barack Obama, and I think that we can, all of us, no matter what our race, learn a good bit from the way in which he took a detriment and, in fact, overcame that detriment and went to the highest spheres of politics in American life.
Let's go back to the phones. We have Eddie on the line in Dallas. Hi, Eddie.
Hi. Professor Kennedy, I'm a big fan of yours. Ever since more than 20 years ago, I bought off the newsstand an issue of a publication called Reconstruction. So here's my question. What's your take on the whole controversy surrounding Cornel West, to a lesser extent, Tavis Smiley, the whole controversy with them and the black intelligentsia, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, sir.
And I'd just like to get your view on it. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Yes, sir. First of all, thank you very much that you were a reader of Reconstruction. I appreciate that. I know Cornel West, and I like Cornel West. I think that Cornel West, unfortunately, what has been too critical of the president. I think that it's fine to be critical of the president, but when again, respectability politics, I think that Cornel West did himself, frankly, a disservice when he talked about the president being a black marionette of Wall Street, that sort of thing. I think that when you say things like that, you lose people. Instead of prompting people to listen carefully to what you say, I think that there were a lot of people who, when they heard that, just dropped Cornel West. And I think that was unfortunate because I think Cornel West is a smart guy. I think he does have good values. I think he does make criticisms that ought to be taken seriously. But I think that he has comported himself and said things that have led many people to take him less seriously than he should be taken.
According to your Wikipedia bio, you were born in the 1950s, mid-50s, which would have made you a teenager in the 60s and into the 70s. I wonder what you think the appropriate way is today to educate young people about the potential value of respectability politics and also the potential pitfalls. How does it look different in 2015?
Well, first of all, most importantly, people need to know their history. People need to know just what has been going on in American life. So, for instance, when I go around to high schools, when I go around to colleges, I ask people things like, well, have you ever heard of Medgar Evers? You know, and people, a lot of young people, all races, you know, never heard of Medgar Evers. Medgar Evers, of course, was the great leader of the NAACP in Mississippi at a time when, you know, you could be just shot down in the streets if you were known to be an activist in the NAACP. People don't know a whole lot. And so the first thing is people need to just be educated better. That's number one. Number two, we need to open ourselves up to debate. You know, I've taken a position with respect to these issues. There are a lot of people whom I deeply respect who disagree with me about this or that or the other. Fine. We can have debates. I don't have to be right. I disagree with things I've written in the past. I disagree with things I wrote 2 years ago. You know, sometimes you make mistakes. Fine. But we have to be willing to put our ideas out there. We need to be willing to set forth our ideas with as much detail as possible. And then we need to be willing to reconsider our ideas and have an open, full debate about things. And so, you know, after we do those things, I think we'll be in a better position.
Is the idea that to achieve full civil rights for any marginalized group, as we, you know, the term we used at the top of the hour, that you need buy-in from people outside that group? Is that frustrating?
Sure, it's frustrating, of course, because to the degree that you need buy-in, you know, I mean, that's difficult. And again, we are facing an unfair situation. But every group faces this. Jews have faced this. Women have faced this. Gay, lesbian people have faced this. Any marginalized group in trying to wring some greater degree of fairness out of society is going to face the sort of dilemmas that I'm writing about. So there's nothing, you know, sort of special. There's nothing particular. There's nothing unique about this vis-a-vis black people. This is just one episode in a much larger story.
Is there anything unique about the way the black civil rights community talks about those disagreements that you referred to earlier among its members?
No. I think that, you know, black people are like everybody else. So there are going to be some people, for instance, some of my students say, gosh, Professor Kennedy, if you have a beef, for instance, with, let's say, Black Lives Matter, can't we just get behind closed doors and talk about that amongst ourselves? Why do you want to write something that's going to be open for the whole world to see? And, you know, all groups engage in that sort of discussion. And what I basically tell them is that, you know, in the world of the Internet, in a world that is as open as, in a society that is as open as our society, the idea of keeping things behind closed doors, I think, is just futile. I think it's better to be transparent. I think it's better to put forth your ideas and be open to disputation.
Randall Kennedy is Michael R. Klein Professor at Harvard Law School and author of the essay Lifting as We Climb, a progressive defense of respectability politics, which appears in the October issue of Harper's. Randall, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for making this time for us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones from Braylon Becton today. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.